the number of failing schools in 2005 was 66%. Now only 26% of the schools in New Orleans are failing. Do we still have work to do? Of course we do. But they're on a positive trajectory, and competition is helping them above all else.
That's the state saying, yeah, we trust you to control your body. And no, you don't need to be on a public pension and a public employee to sell someone a bottle of liquor. It's not a core function.
Has been around since 1968, the magazine for free minds and free markets. I talk to a lot of people who are unaware that we are published by a foundation, a nonprofit, 501c3, correct? Not,
yes. Yes, that's still true.
Just trying to see if you guys are paying any attention at all. Not aware that we do, in addition to publishing a magazine and a website and a video journalism site, we do a lot of public policy research and get things done. And when people ask me sort of what's the difference between the foundation side activities and what the magazine does, well, magazine, we talk about issues, complain about issues a lot, and then the foundation side, public policy side, actually makes policy happen, actually gets stuff done. And as paradoxical as it might sound in these troubled times that we live in, it's precisely now when we tend to get the most stuff done, when there are eager customers wanting to figure out how to fix messed up education systems and how to save a lot of money in cash-strapped circumstances to try to make government work better, preferably by doing less. So we're going to hear about that today from Lisa Snell, who heads up our education efforts and really one of the most exciting areas that we're working on right now. Kind of blow your mind, so you better blow their minds. And Harris Kenny is going to talk about our some of the privatization stuff that we've been working on. And they're going to both talk for about 15, 20 minutes, and we'll have time for questions and back and forth. But first, let's give it up for Lisa Snell to talk to us about stuff.
So at the Reason Foundation for Education Policy, we really work for the idea that anything that breaks up the money and attaches it to the backs of children is much better than the status quo. Right now in the United States, we spend $600 billion a year on K-12 education. That's up 68% in 2009-2010, real dollars from 1990. So we spend 68% more, which it was $356 billion in 1990. So we literally spend billions of dollars every year on K-12 education. And so when you think about markets and education, which is what we're all working for, yes, ideally we would like to be over here on the continuum with a complete free market in education with no government involvement. But the reality is that we're over here, right? Government controls 99.9% of the money, $600 billion, and we have to find a way to get from here to here. So that's what I do. That's my job, is how can we move the ball from the government controlling 99% of $600 billion to parents and families and the private sector investing $600 billion, or probably a lot less, in today's dollars in K-12 education. So I've been working in LA, so to give you an example of the kind of public policy that we do, I've been working in Los Angeles Unified School District, which has 700,000 students, is the second largest school district in the nation, and it's a nightmare, I'll tell you. And they have a plan, they have a new superintendent. They want to move to a system where all the money on a per student basis follows the students, and the public 800 schools in LA Unified are competing for those dollars within a district model. They have about 70 schools that are doing that now with innovative principals that control their budgets, and they have to get their kids to come and enroll. They're not charter schools, they're district schools. And so I'm trying to help them move to 800 schools doing that, So at least they're competing within a public system. So I've been interviewing principals in schools all over Los Angeles this summer. So last week, I did an interview in the Santee Education Complex. It was one of these multi-million dollar new built schools 5 years ago in LA that was going to change everything for the district, right? I think it cost something like $150 million, which is like a bargain in Los Angeles for a high school. And it crosses two streets over 3rd Street in downtown Los Angeles. And it has sound rooms that any band would envy to do recordings in. It has professional kitchens like Hell's Kitchens. It has these literally multi-million dollar facilities. Once the school opened, it promptly became the 3rd lowest scoring high school in Los Angeles, right? So all that investment in those facilities didn't help. So I was interviewing the principal who just recently got control of her budget about, you know, what per student funding would mean to her. And so when I got done with the interview, I went to leave the front office and the door was locked. It's this huge complex across two streets. It's chain link, padlocks and barbed wire, and there's one door to get out of the place, and it was locked. And so I go back through the school to the building where I was interviewing the principal, and the door was locked. And so I started going from gate to gate looking for a janitor, a principal, a teacher, somebody that would let me out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Wednesday out of the Santee Education Complex. There was nobody there. So for an hour, I tried to get out of this huge, I could like see my car like over parked on the street, but I could not get out of the campus. So the metaphor to me for why we do school choice is not only do public schools in America seem like prisons, I can tell you from firsthand experience, they are prisons, and there are that once you're locked in, there's no way to get out. Now, eventually, I got a hold of the principal by texting and emailing her. She opened the door. She came out an hour later and let me off of the campus. But Santee Education Complex, it is a brand new facility. It looks like a prison. Its name sounds like a prison. And once you're a kid going to that school, you're literally locked into that campus. Another high school I was visiting in Los Angeles, you know, in these troubled times of, you know, $17,000 per student in Los Angeles Unified, they can't buy basic supplies for their classrooms. So when you go into the office to interview the principal, they have lists of things that they want parents to buy. And it looks like Christmas time when you have Toys for Tots. They have barrels where they want parents to donate supplies to the schools because they literally don't have any money at the school level. So they have a list of what they need. And the first thing on the list is for lockdown, we need kitty litter, we need sanitary wipes, we need toilet paper, and we need air freshener. So I guess for lockdown, they were going to have, right, the theory is, right, if they get locked into the classrooms, that the kids will go to the bathroom in kitty litter. Like this is their supply list in an urban high school in Los Angeles. So when you think about what parents want, yes, you want high-achieving schools for your kids and you want your kids to learn, but I think an even more basic thing that you want is you don't want your kids to have to use a cat box in their public high school to go to the restroom. Okay, so that's the kind of thing basically that we're looking at is schools look like prisons and they have supply lists that include kitty litter as like a fundamental thing that they want. So there's something inherently wrong with that. The good news here is that the policy work that we do to try to get money to follow the children, and this is a huge coalition of groups that are working on this. Reason Foundation does a lot of different things. We do Reason TV about the state of education and school choice. We publish long-form journalism in the magazine. Catherine Mangu Ward has written lots of great articles. We publish studies. We go and we try to help policymakers to change conditions like in Los Angeles Unified. The good news is that in 2011, school choice winning. Since we're in Las Vegas, let's just start with a bet. Jay Matthews, who is one of the most well-known education reporters at the Washington Post, bet Greg Forrester, who's a senior fellow at the Milton Friedman Foundation, now called the Foundation for Educational Choice, that there won't be a wave of pro-voucher votes across the country. Greg bet him that he was wrong, that in 2011 there would be at least 10 new legislative changes for school choice. I'm happy to report that Greg has now been able to double down on the bet, and there's 19 programs, and there's another one about to come online. So school choice is winning in 2011.
Just to clarify, when was the bet made?
So it was made actually in, I think, February of 2011.
Oh, wow.
So it was made just this year. So these are all 19 new school choice programs, this legislative, either expanding existing programs to more kids or new programs coming online. And I'm not going to read through all of these, but they're things like education savings account in Arizona, you know, special needs vouchers in Utah. But I'm going to go through some of the more significant changes this year in school choice. First of all, on April 4th, 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to tax credits, meaning that people can actually keep their own money or corporations can donate money to provide scholarships for kids to go to private schools. They wrote that because tax credits leave money in the hands of taxpayers, they never become public funds. As a result, under federal law, taxpayers do not have standing to challenge the program. Just in Arizona, 30,000 kids at 370 private schools, and then everybody else who does tax credits have a stamp of approval from the Supreme Court. They're winning. Boom. In D.C., as part of the budget deal, Congress reauthorized the District of Columbia School Voucher Program. 1,700 kids in D.C., and they're actually going to expand it to a lot more kids, at 50 private schools, winning. Kaboom! This is an interesting program in Denver, in Douglas County. The school board actually approved the first voucher program approved by a local school board so that within the district, the kids can use vouchers to go to private schools. The first year of the program, 500 students will receive $4,500 to attend private school. So it's a small program, it's a small start, but it sets a precedent that you don't have to have a state program, you don't have to have a federal program. School districts can just decide to send their own kids to private schools, and the money can follow kids. Indiana passes the largest school voucher program in the nation. They actually have 61,000 to qualify for a family of four, which means a lot more kids will be eligible. The first year, 7,500 kids will be able to use a voucher. Second year, 15,000 kids. And then in year three, there will be no limit on families that can use a voucher if they meet the income qualification in Indiana. Pow. So we have these 19 new programs, but even before that, in 2010, 2011, programs that are already online, there's 20 school vouchers or tax credit programs in 2010. 11 of these are vouchers, 9 are tax credits. $700 million of admittedly $600 billion is dedicated to funding school voucher and tax credits. But the significant thing is that in the past 5 years, that has more than doubled because it was less than $300 million. And this expansion is happening rapidly in these current programs. So Ohio just quadrupled the number to 60,000 kids that will be able to use vouchers by 2013. Milwaukee, which in their city has 20,000 kids using vouchers, just added 3,000 kids. And then in Racine, Wisconsin, they started a new program that will start with 750 kids. So existing programs are expanding, new programs are coming online. You can just see this trajectory since 2000, that we have a much larger number of kids that now are actually using Milton Friedman's version of vouchers or the vision of tax credits to go to private schools. I'll let that speak for itself. The other thing is that we know that school choice works. There's been 10 empirical studies using gold standard where it's random assignment, and all of them have found that in 9 cases they improved student outcomes. In 1 case there was no difference, but they all did it for a lot less money. 19 studies have found that they improve outcomes for public school students that are in schools near voucher programs or school choice programs. So it lifts all boats, as Carolyn Hoxby would say. School choice works. It benefits kids that get school choice. It benefits kids that stay in the public system. Charter schools are another huge area where we are winning. They actually are the largest example of education privatization in the nation, where individual schools have contracts with government authorizers, and the only way they get paid is if kids enroll and sign up. So charter schools are often thought of as kind of a marginal school choice, but I would make the argument that economically, as far as the money is concerned, they work just like a voucher or tax credit, because the school does not get paid unless the kids sign up. We have 5,000 charter schools in the United States, more than 2 million children, and there's an estimated 500,000 kids on waiting lists for charter schools. Charter school market share. The interesting development is in a lot of cities across the United States, charter schools are taking more and more of the market from the public school district. There's 14 communities with more than 20% of the public school students enrolled in charter schools, 72 communities with more than 10%. 3 cities have more than 1/3 of their public school students, and those would be Detroit at 32%, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans with 71%. Let's talk about New Orleans for a minute. It is the most market-driven school system in the United States. 71% of all public school students go to charter schools. These are schools with individual contracts. They have to show financial responsibility and student performance. 77% of all kids in K-8 go to charter schools. And it's funny because people used to accuse charter schools of cherry-picking students, but in a city like New Orleans, if every kid goes to a charter school, that really becomes an irrelevant argument in terms of cherry-picking. So we have a true test going on in New Orleans about do markets and education work. So just for example, the dropout rate in New Orleans from 9th through 12th grade fell 31% in 3 years. Since 2005, New Orleans dropout rate for high school students has been cut in half. We know that they are on an upward trajectory in terms of student performance. The number of failing schools in 2005 was 66%. Now only 26% of the schools in New Orleans are failing. Do we still have work to do? Of course we do, but they're on a positive trajectory and competition is helping them above all else. Boom. So now let's talk a little bit about some of the policy work that we do. We are working to try to get the money to follow the students. So in the state of Louisiana, where New Orleans has really shown that market forces work, we're working to get a statewide law so that the money would follow the kid to any school in the state. And this year we were able to get 11 parishes or school districts to pilot that program to be coming online next year. And what we do is we actually take kind of a tiger team of principals, business administrators, and superintendents. And in this picture, we have Paul Pastorek, who was the state superintendent in Louisiana. And then Andre Alonso, Baltimore has become one of the highest performing schools as far as money following the child. And we would take these people to show the stakeholders in Louisiana that if Baltimore can do it, if principals in Oakland can do this, that they could do this statewide. And so they do have a resolution in the funding formula to do this, and the first year they're starting with several new parishes. So that's the kind of on-the-ground policy work that we do, is we try to help people to implement what we preach, that the money should follow the child and that there should be no residential assignment in America today. The next area that I'll touch on really briefly is just the growth of online learning and virtual schools, which means that we can customize education in multiple ways. The K-12 segment of the online learning industry is growing faster than any other segment, with 17%, sorry, growth rate. The online learning is a $25 billion industry by 2015. Almost all 50 states have statewide programs where some kids go to online schools and take virtual classes, and that's expected to grow by 45%. And I'll just give you one example of that. In Utah, they passed the first statewide online school choice program. And what that means is that any high school student in Utah can take two courses a semester from any online provider, universities, for-profits, nonprofits. They can completely customize that percent of their education and have school choice without ever leaving their school district. And that money on an, and this is really what we want to get to, is we don't want to have the money follow the child to the school. We want the money to follow the child from a variety of sources to completely customize their education. And this would be an example of that. So, you know, if you want to take an advanced calculus class here, or you want to take a karate class here, that money, that segment of that money is attached to you, not to the school. And so that's really what Utah has done, and they're winning for that. And I would say they're also part of the boom squad. Boom. And then the next and the final thing that I'll close with, and I'm sure I'm almost out of time, is this new phenomenon called the parent trigger. And this is still true today. In Compton Unified, their high schools are no longer accredited because they're so bad. But guess what? The people that work there still get paid, and the kids still go to school there, even though they actually are not accredited any longer by the state of California. And 1.5 of Compton Unified students make it to college. And I'll just add that when you look at math test scores for 10th graders in Compton, less than 1% of them are scoring proficient in Compton Unified. And that's, no, this is Compton Unified, the school district in Compton, California. I'm sorry. So it's a California school district that doesn't have accredited high schools, that sends 1.5% of its students to college, and has less than 1% proficient in math in 10th grade, and all the adults still get paid and show up for work every day. So this new law in California called the parent trigger says that if schools are failing, parents should have the power to organize and pick who they want to run their schools. So if 51% of parents present a petition to the school district and say, we want KIPP to run our school, or, you know, Green Dot to run our school, or whoever they want to run their school, there's a law in California that says the district has to make that happen. And so the first school that did that was called McKinley Elementary. So these parents wanted to start before their kids get to those high schools in Compton. And so, of course, Compton Unified, even though it's state law, refused to accept the petition. And they wanted to, and this is, again, almost an entirely Hispanic community, very low income, they wanted to make every parent come in to the district for a personal interview to verify their signature. And they said then they might accept the petition. But luckily, a Superior Court judge issued an injunction against the school district in Compton Unified's favor, and they said that they violated the parents' constitutional rights, which they did. And they ordered Compton to count the petitions. And this was a huge victory for parents. And since then, the state of California have come up with some regulations, which are not completely good in all cases, but it means that districts will not be able to deny parents the right to participate in the parent trigger law. So again, we are winning. In 2011, school choice is really winning. And I just want to end by saying that I would, if you went to the session on National School Choice Week in January, that I would really encourage you all to participate in that. That we were able to screen the lottery at the Silent Movie Theater in Los Angeles, and we had an event in DC. And we got all kinds of people that wouldn't necessarily know about school choice to learn about this important issue. So I really think that all from all different fronts, from homeschools to charter schools, More and more of the public school students are opting out and the teachers are opting out, and we just have to go forward with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lisa. And if you're not aware of the miracle that's happening in New Orleans post-Katrina with how they've reorganized education there, I highly recommend you go and just Google it, or preferably go to Reason.com and see some of the videos that we've done about that at Reason TV and other articles that we've written on the topic. It's amazing. It'll stagger you. To hear more about winning, we are going to introduce Charlie Sheen. We're introducing Harris. Harris, can you tell us how we're winning privatization, if you will?
Can you guys hear me all right? Is that good? So thanks, Matt, and thank you, Lisa. Before I start, I just kind of want to frame, I'm talking about privatization right now and today. And this is, what is privatization? When a lot of people hear that word, maybe not people in this room, but they think, well, didn't Bush do that with Social Security or try? And wasn't it the worst idea ever? And that's the only like association that a lot of people have with privatization. So just to clarify, basically privatization just means expanding the role that the private sector plays in delivering goods and services in the economy. It's not a scary thing, it's very simple. In fact, almost everything we use every day is delivered by the private sector. So just to kind of dispel, in case anyone's unfamiliar with the term, privatization is a tool for policymakers to use. It's one of many tools. It's not a cure-all, it's not a catch-all, and it's not easy to do. You see in the former Soviet Union, a lot of those eastern satellite states, you see how difficult it is for those states to transition from a control economy to a market economy. And what the United States is doing and states are doing on a local level is that same thing. You have state control over aspects of public service delivery, or trying to transition to more of a market system. So it's not easy, and it takes time. That's what privatization is. Why do it? What's the impetus? Let's say you don't know anything about it, you don't care about it, why should you care? We're broke, that's it. The government doesn't have money. If you're not familiar with the federal government fiscal situation, it's a nightmare. I don't know what to tell you if you haven't heard about that, but it's just not money there. You don't have to look very far to hear that story. At the state level, it's just as serious. In fiscal year 2011, the government uses their own years for some reason, so they use the fiscal year system for accounting. Last fiscal year, they had $130 billion in cumulative budget deficits at the state level. And this upcoming fiscal year, 2012, states are facing over $100 billion again in cumulative budget deficits. And I'm just going to focus on states here because state and local governments, basically, they're very closely tied. Their budgets are closely tied. So that's where my focus is going to be, at the state level privatization. How did they take care of it? How did they take care of it in 2011? States received close to $60 billion in federal stimulus money that they used just to plug their budgets. That's it. In 2011. In 2012, that number is going from $60 billion down to $6 billion. So now that the taxpayers' credit card is out, they can't rely on that federal money, what are they going to do? Now we're seeing the states, we're welcoming them to the recession. Basically, you know, we've been here for since 2008. You know, the water's pretty warm, so why don't you hop in and start cutting spending now, because they've been able to basically kick the can down the road. And that's why you're hearing these dramatic budget battles and fights going on in state capitals around the country, is that they're finally entering the recession. And that's why politicians sound serious now, because the heat's on for the first time. We've been dealing with it for 3 years, so. Federal situation, like I said, I like to call it a SAFU. It's a situation awful, further effed up, so we're not even gonna go there. I'm gonna say one cool thing at the end that the federal government's doing, which is encouraging. But so now to kind of go on. States are doing a lot of really cool things. You have multi-billion dollar public-private partnerships expanding surface transportation in Texas. You have port dredging, partnering with the private sector to deepen the Miami port in Florida. Toxic waste cleanup in New Jersey, my home state. airport privatization, custodial services, animal shelters in Missouri. States are doing lots of cool things, so it's better to kind of look at individual cases and just kind of see the story as it's developing rather than focus on the macro. So I'm gonna start with Minnesota. And Minnesota's in the middle of a state shutdown right now. It's been about 2 weeks. They have a $5 billion deficit that they're negotiating for fiscal year 2012. And if you're people who pay attention to these things and have time to, know that this isn't new. Minnesota had a shutdown, an 8-day shutdown in 2005. And the way they solved it last time was not by being innovative. Then Governor Tim Pawlenty decided to raise taxes on cigarettes. And not surprisingly, here they are, seven years later, and the problem's back. And the problem is spending. Spending has skyrocketed over the years, and they can't rely on these quick fix tax increases because it's not going to solve the problem. Their budget deficit's projected to continue to go up, or their budget spending is supposed to keep going up. In 2012, they're supposed to spend $45 billion, and then by 2015, they're supposed to spend $53 billion. So the spending just keeps going up, and that's adjusted for inflation, adjusted for population growth. What's happening? What's happening in the state? Parks are shutting down. Everything is shutting down because they can't deliver the services. And what's happening as a result? Well, for example, state parks have seen graffiti, vandalism, and serious problems in parks and other facilities. And that is the problem with this public sector provision of this service. So that's where privatization kind of offers a solution. So we say, well, what if the private sector managed those parks? And they didn't have to rely on the state budget process, policymakers, to decide whether or not they want to fund law enforcement or parks. And the National Park Service, surprisingly, has been doing this for 25 years. So during the 1995 shutdown, privately operated parks stayed open. And as states have struggled with this spending problem, you've seen states look to privatization for state parks. So Arizona, they released an RFI, a request for information. They opened up their books and asked private operators, hey, how would you do this? We can't afford to fund this right now. How would you do it? Federal government's been doing it for 25 years. Why don't we start trying? Florida, you're seeing a similar conversation happen where they're saying, we don't want to have to pick this as a priority. Let's see the private sector operate it and see what happens. So as far as winning, I think that's an exciting thing. It's fundamentally changing the conversation about conservation and about protecting the environment. And instead it's saying, hey, the private sector can do this. They're good at this. The government's clearly failing. So why don't we try it out? And so that's really new at the state level. I think that's winning in a really exciting way. And so that's something to look out for in the coming year. Oh, and by the way, just like, hey, where are our allies on this, right? The environmentalists must really like privatization because it can keep parks open. No. Unfortunately, there's been some pushback. I spoke with someone at the Nature Conservancy when California, they tried to tax cars to save parks in California. I don't know the connection there, but they thought that was a good idea. After it failed, spoke to someone at the Nature Conservancy and said, hey, we have this new model, state park privatization model, what do you think? Email back. We're not interested, but good luck. And I don't know why not. I mean, talk to somebody else. I mean, legitimately, it was like, you know, good luck. Talk to somebody else. Talk to another organization. So you'd even think that a park advocacy group would say, you know what, fine. Like, we're not crazy about it, but we care about parks. So what I kind of say is, I care about parks so much, I don't want the government doing it. I don't want them to pick between cops or park rangers, because cops win. You know, there's priorities, and parks aren't going to win that. So in some way, privatization is a way to say, we care about these things so much, we want people that care about them to support them, rather than be a victim to this political process. And so I know parks aren't a major issue, but to me, that's really winning, because it's changing the dialogue. So I'm excited about that, and I like parks, so that's kind of a personal. Changing gears totally, ABC privatization, so that's alcoholic beverage control. Everybody's familiar with Prohibition. When that ended, you have this ABC system that's in place since the 1930s. And what does it look like? Well, 30 states went with the tax and regulate approach, where they said, we're going to have three tiers. There's manufacturing, wholesale distribution, and then retail. And we're going to allow the private sector to do those things, and we're going to basically oversee them, tax and regulate. 20 states, which I'm going to call the nanny states for conversation purposes, the nanny states decided that they wanted a big role, a public sector role, in alcohol distribution. So basically today there are 18 states where the state either owns a liquor store or owns a liquor warehouse and doesn't allow the private sector to compete with that. In these 18 states, the argument is that's a core governmental function. Now, two states have privatized since the 30s. those are Iowa and West Virginia. And as we all know, they have fallen into complete chaos, and nobody goes there anymore.
Have you been to West Virginia?
They're actually fine. There's not alcohol everywhere, and the children aren't alcoholics. The states are fine. And in the other 30 states, everybody's fine, too. Yes, people can be trusted to consume alcohol. You know, and so it's kind of, you can run into these absurd arguments of public safety, and if we allow this, there's going to be total chaos. Well, no, there's not. The other 30 states are doing it. And so you see people fighting this tooth and nail in these 18 control states when there's obvious evidence everywhere else that people can make those decisions for themselves. And so that dialogue is being pushed. It's going to be really strong coming up in Washington and Virginia especially, and Utah and Pennsylvania as well. It's kind of heating up in those four states. And so that's winning. That's the state saying, yeah, we trust you to control your body. And no, you don't need to be on a public pension and a public employee to sell someone a bottle of liquor. It's not a core function. And so that's winning too, because it's really changing the dialogue in those states. We actually, Reason Foundation Director of Government Reform, Leonard Gilroy, worked with Bob McDonald in Virginia on that ABC, basically that ABC privatization conversation. And he advised Governor McDonald and his team on ways to make it happen. And this is, I think, where Reason Foundation, and we work partner with state think tanks to make it happen, because it's messy. We sit down and we talk with lawmakers, and they say, well, we're making a lot of money. We don't want to stop doing that. Okay, yeah, but you're a lawmaker, you're the government, you don't want to make money selling liquor. That's not the government's job. You know, and so we really rely on innovative policymakers that want to change how things operate and really care about a free society. And so Bob McDonald, fortunately, is an ally on this issue, and he's interested in it. So we're able to partner with like-minded lawmakers who don't worry about the revenue, about the fact that, hey, we're making great money off this. Because if that's the case, the state's going to start getting into some pretty dubious things just to make money. I don't think that's the way states should be operating. And so that's what we're working towards there. So you can see ABC privatization definitely come up in the future. Kind of similar vice privatization. Illinois did something awesome this last year. They privatized their lottery system. And like once again, state-run lotteries, why? That's not a state function. I think almost every state has it, but Illinois privatized theirs. And in this landmark deal, they're going to get close to $5 billion over the next 5 years. And this lottery privatization deal, through the private operator, they're going to get $1 billion more than they would have had under public provision. So they're getting more money. They're not having to run it anymore. All 170 state employees are staying on, being kept on by the private operator, and they're hiring 100 more. So you're seeing, so in this case, this is showing that no, privatization is not anti-labor. In fact, most privatization contracts include clauses where, hey, you have to keep these employees because they're part of the organization, and you can fire, you know, five or less percent of employees who are just awful. So privatization, sometimes it's put into that nexus of, well, you either are for the people or against the people. It's not like that. It's not that simple. In fact, that's a deceiving argument that a lot of people use. And this contract is a perfect example. Every employee is staying on board, revenue's going up, and the state isn't selling lotto tickets anymore. You know, and they're keeping the money, though. They're going to keep an operating agreement, so the state's going to be able to maintain revenue. So that's an exciting one. That's winning in a big way. And this was a contract signed, heard around the world. I read an article last week about how the Philippines are considering this as well. So I don't know the impact. I don't know if they read the Illinois headlines, but they're considering doing the same thing in the Philippines, privatizing it. I guess they have corruption problems over there. And now this is a little bit of a twist on the privatization conversation, but basically I look at this as privatizing film financing. 44 states, in addition to that, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, have these things called movie production incentives, where basically, if you're producing a movie, you can get tax breaks, tax credits, refunds, discounts, free police cordoning off the streets. You get all these handouts for making a movie. So in my opinion, this is, and I think it's safe to say, this is publicly financed film. So really, I think what we need to move towards is privatizing film production, because the state has a role in 44 states right now. And this is being pushed back hard. There's 17 states that are talking about repealing these. And this is an easy one. I mean, they're handouts to Hollywood, period. There's no other way to describe it. And the supporters say, oh, well, look at all the economic development impact and all that. There's some exciting stuff happening there. And I think that you're going to see that pushback come hard in all these states. Colorado, Michigan, New Mexico, that's winning, getting the government out of picking industries and using political favor to generate things that they want. And I'm just going to wrap up here. The most exciting thing, I think by far, and this is happening at the federal level, and this is the privatization of aerospace travel and transportation of cargo and astronauts, or cosmonauts, if we have any Russian attendees here. Basically, in last year, President Obama canceled President Bush's plan to return to the moon. He has instead shifted, and I really don't understand the impetus behind this, but I think it may have just been despite President Bush, I don't know. But he's privatizing our private sector transportation. So now, instead of using this NASA shuttle program, these shuttles are 30 years old, and when the last takeoff went off last week or 2 weeks ago, people were upset, saying, is this the end of NASA? Is this the end of American space shuttles? Well, no, it's a 30-year-old ship. It's time to invent a new ship. It's a time to find a new way to get into space. You know, people were really upset, and NPR was doing a story, well, have America's dreams died? No, it's a new model. 30 years we've been using the same shuttle. Like, why don't we innovate, for God's sakes? So now the private sector is stepping in. There's a host of companies. I've got like 12 companies here I can read off, but you'd get bored. I'll just give you one number to get excited about this. NASA's number for sending an astronaut into space is $300 million. There's a company called SpaceX that was funded by Elon Musk, and they've got an estimate that by 2013 they're going to be able to send an astronaut into space for $20 million. That's awesome. You go from $300 million to get a guy into a space down to $20 million. That's winning. And to me, that's the most exciting thing. You get the public sector out of space delivery, and who knows what we're capable of. That's the thing to look for. There's tons of companies innovating. Space tourism, the sky is not the limit. There is no limit to what the private sector can do there, and I think that's winning in a big way. And thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Chris. We have plenty of time for some questions here. To reiterate what Nick Gillespie said earlier in a previous panel, please keep brief, make it a question, and if I can ask one more thing, is that before you ask it, wait for this. Which young gentleman is going to have the spry legs this time? Jim Epstein over here. Say hi to Jim. Wait for him to run over and put the microphone under your chin. So, hands raised for questions for Lisa Snell or Harris Kenny. Privatization winning, Charlie Sheen, cosmonauts. Sir, yes, sir.
Well, I have a, thank you. I have two related questions from our advocate of privatization of education. First, how do you respond to the purists, the libertarian purists, who first of all don't want to see any education ever financed by people who don't have children? Milton Friedman actually used to say, argue years ago, that it's a positive externality, so everybody should pay for it. But he's since abandoned that. And the purists, of course, are also especially concerned that it's a Faustian bargain that schools are under the supervision of the state. There's too much meddling that way. But really, my related question to that, and perhaps you can answer the question in this way, what is your vision for where this is going? Where would you like to ideally see the state of education, of schooling, 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Where is this taking us? And of course, I have a related question for the privatization advocate. Is there, I mean, oddly, of course, you're talking about a lottery. Now, that's kind of a state monopoly, you know, so make other kind of gambling illegal, you've got the lottery. And also, the other related danger, by at least according to legend, according to the folklore, all the privatization in Russia led to a Russian mafia. Are you concerned about that kind of handing favors out to privileged friends? Those are my two questions. I'd like to hear about education.
That was only two questions. Are you sure about that? Okay. I'm just kidding. So we have an argument that we should have the complete separation of school and state, that people do not have children should not have to subsidize people with children. That, and I'm telling you, that would be great. I mean, and so we have $600 billion that is a government monopoly now that everybody does pay for, and that's the reality that we face. As to what I would like it to look like, if we think about how higher education is funded, which is by all means not a perfect model, but I want it to be like going to Metro PCS instead of Verizon, that you have a no-contract model where if we, given that it already is a public good at this point and we waste this huge amount of taxpayer money, that the money truly is attached to the backs of children and we no longer have residential assignment anywhere or seat-based time anywhere, that it is just buying units of service and that money is attached to kids, so we don't have charter schools and voucher schools and nonprofit schools and private schools, that parents have financial resources that they buy education with, whatever that might look like. And I do truly think that that's where we are going, and that as we move into online education, the cost of that, if you think of Khan Academy, which is K-H-A-N, it is basically free, and it has hundreds of lectures online that parents can use with everything from, you know, Algebra 1 to physics to history and literature. I think the cost per unit is going to rapidly fall so that it doesn't cost as much because we don't have to pay for infrastructure and teachers as much as we do now. But until that time, I think we need to move at least to a financing model that looks like how we finance other things. And, you know, like cell phones are still regulated by the government. Could they be cheaper? Could we have even more choice than we do now? Yes. But I would much rather have our education look how we choose our cell phone service than what it looks like now, which is, depending on where you live, you get actually a number or an assignment. And so, you know, unfortunately, we aren't starting from a point where we can design a market with no government involvement. And so the only way to get from here to there is to empower parents to control the resources and the money. And that's the reality that we face.
And I guess my answer on the privatization would be, I definitely have that conversation a lot. And people push back on that and are concerned about that. Are we enabling, maybe even making the state stronger and giving it more control of these contracts? And can we trust the government to oversee these contracts? It's hard and it's not easy, but people are drinking water now, driving on roads now, going to parks now, kids are in schools now, they're in the welfare system now. And so I think there's an imperative, an immediate need to improve the quality of life, and if this is a tool to do it. And I think the idea of waiting for utopia, not that you were saying that, but I think generally that's the argument, we should wait for everything to become perfect. I don't think that's acceptable. I think we can make society better now than we have it imperative. California's prison system bumps up Brown v. Plaza that ruined the mental health and physical medical health basically situation with inmates is unconstitutional. California's using privately operated prisons to keep those inmates. Those inmates, while they're in those privately operated prisons, are in fantastic conditions. In the state facilities, it's horrible, third world. Do I want to see sentencing reform? Absolutely. But if someone's going to be in custody, they deserve to not be in those third world conditions. And so I think it is a compromise in order to improve the quality of life right now for people.
We've got time for about one more back here.
It's not a question, but I thought, I spoke to this guy in South Africa. He wrote a book called Unchain the Child, and he was discussing to me what free market education might look like, because the thing about free markets is it's not outcomes based. We don't have a vision of how we want to do. We're not going to force everything to reach that vision. It's about setting the right principles now and then seeing what the outcome is. And he imagined if you had a completely free market competitive education system, maybe it would be a bit like clothing retail, because each and every human being is a completely unique individual and we all have unique tastes, gifts, talents. So if that could be provided by the private sector, you could go into an education mall, for example, and you could buy courses that you want to do. If you want to do advanced maths, you could do a whole bunch of maths courses. If that's not your thing, you could focus on business or art. So you wouldn't just have to choose the school that you're going to. You could choose your range of courses more like a university, but it wouldn't be provided by one central organization. It would be more like going shopping for clothes. You could get a shirt from this store, a pair of jeans from this store, and I mean, imagine a world like that, where every single human being could choose their whole education. They could explore. They've got that first 20 years of their life to learn about what they're good at, to explore the options. And then in that system, you might say, oh, but that is only good for the rich people. But the clothing provides clothes for very poor people. It provides clothing for very wealthy people. And you could have that whole system competing with public schools, you know, tax-paid schools for the people who really can't afford it at all. They could be a part of that whole competitive market system. So that's the kind of vision that I'm hoping to see. Well, that could happen with free market education.
Thank you very much. It's 2:20. We're bumping up against the 2:30 start time of our next panel that I hope everyone sticks around for. Nick will be talking about new media if he wakes up. thank you to Lisa Snell and Harris Kenny talking about how we're winning in the face of losing.